Cardiovascular disease has been the leading cause of death for 100 years in a row. Why is that? Why aren't the statins curing us of heart disease? Maybe it's because heart disease is more than just about cholesterol. But what can we do? How can a wise athlete fend off the leading cause of death? Today on episode 136, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Twyman, who is an expert in cardiovascular risk reduction, mitochondrial health, and circadian biology. His focus is on the prevention and early detection of heart disease. He says, "Heart attack prevention is my passion, to get to the root cause of your cardiovascular issues." Cardiovascular disease has been the number one boogeyman for me. Got my grandfather, my father, and was no doubt coming from me. Until recently, I have been a big believer in the power of lowering my ApoB particles to as small a number as possible to reduce and possibly eliminate any progression in the development of plaques in my arteries. What I did not expect is that the side effects of using the medications to get my ApoB to such levels would have consequences. My conversation with Dr. Twyman has been instrumental in me finding a new perspective on cardiovascular disease. And I hope this conversation will be helpful to you as well. All right, let's talk to Dr. Twyman. Dr. Michael Twyman, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I understand that you are an expert in three things, and I'll give you a chance to explain to us how they're all related. But you're an expert in cardiovascular risk reduction, mitochondrial health, and circadian biology. First of all, is that true? Those are things that you consider yourself an expert in? And if so, how are they connected?
Those are things that I focus on for my own health and the health of my patients. So yeah, if people want to call me an expert in it, okay. But I think I'm doing pretty well with it. I have pretty good results for myself. So,
well, that's pretty good. I probably could use your help myself. But these things are connected, I'm pretty sure, based on some talks that I've heard you give, that cardiovascular risk is not a thing like a bomb that somebody teleported into your heart, but rather it's sort of the end of a long chain of things. Somewhere back on this chain, there are one or more root causes that have led to this situation or are causing it now. And they're related to these things, these circadian biology and mitochondrial health. Anyway, that's what I'm hoping that we're going to get into. I got to say that before I launch you into your bit here, this has been a very troubling space for me. I mean, I've got some heart disease and I'm taking a statin and I resisted it for a long time and because I was afraid of side effects and I have side effects and I'm trying to deal with that. But the whole space for a layman, for a person like me, it's so confusing because you really don't find a middle ground. That's where you come in. But mostly you don't find the middle ground. What you find is two camps. One is the leading cardiologist type people, and they say, hey, statins are great. They're this wonderful tool. They really, help people. And you should take a statin. If you've got some risk, you should take a statin. And everybody has risk. Oh, and lower your saturated fat too. And it used to be that they would say, oh, and side effects are mostly in your head. So just, don't worry about that. They have sort of come around to saying, okay, yeah, there are side effects and probably a low dose statin is better. And you can combine it with some things. But anyway, there's the statins is great crowd. And then on the other side, there is the, oh, LDL doesn't matter. It's a conspiracy, right? The big pharma. And statins are a tactic to kill down the population. But LDL doesn't matter as long as I'm metabolically healthy. And oh, by the way, that means that I'm low carb. And so I invited you on to the show, Dr. Twyman, because I found you to be like the only person that I ever bumped into on the internet who is in the middle between these groups. What do you have to say?
Well, I'm a board certified cardiologist. I was an invasive cardiologist for many years, taking care of people who were very sick in the ICU and the cath lab. Saw a lot of patients die under my days in the hospital, and was always kind of wondering like what else could we have done for these people, because a lot of times those patients were already on statins, already on blood pressure medicines, already on aspirin. What else were we not paying attention to? And I really think it comes down to endothelial health, oxidative stress, inflammation. I'm sure we'll talk about those things, but atherosclerosis is still the number one thing that kills people. Yeah. In the United States, every 40 seconds, somebody's having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And often the first sign that they have heart disease is that heart attack. And that's what I'm really trying to prevent at this stage. You know, my practice right now is exclusively focused on heart attack and stroke risk reduction. Wow. You know, if you've already had an event, we'll help you prevent you from having a second event. If you've never had an event, the goal is you never will end up in the hospital and meet my colleagues. So atherosclerosis is common. And if you don't go looking for it, you're not going to find it. And the traditional tools don't often find it until it's almost too late in some individuals. And so are stands useful in people? Of course, but not for everybody. They should not be in the water. And as you mentioned, some people do have side effects. They are real. Oftentimes it's muscle side effects, muscle pain, weakness, tightness. Those aren't in your head. Those are real. But does that mean you shouldn't lower your cholesterol at all? No, it means you're just maybe statin intolerant and should consider another agent. Yeah, you know, you can use, there's probably like 6-7 other agents on top of my head. And there's a whole host of lifestyle and supplements you can consider as well to get your lipoproteins and ApoB down if you need to. So you treat the individual who's sitting in front of you. How are you going to get their 60,000 miles of blood vessels healthy?
All right. Well, why don't we find out? Here's what I'd like to cover today at enough of a level that it'll be meaningful to people. They'll get an inkling of what to do or at least what you do for people. And they can, you know, look for you or somebody like you. The three things that I'd really like to touch on would be, why do the plaques happen? I mean, is it inevitable? Is this just like a normal thing that happens to human beings? But even, you know, whether it's inevitable or not, what is it? What are the set of things or sequence of things that is causing this to happen? Okay, the second thing would then be, because it actually doesn't happen to some people, or it happens very slowly and not until late in their lives, how do I know if I'm a person who's it's happening sooner or maybe in a very sort of normal, common way, you know, maybe in my 50s or 60s, but I'm not getting blood tests and that sort of thing. So, you know, how might I tell? Maybe I can tell by some symptom of my body or test that you might do. And then the most important thing of all would be, well, what can we do about it? You know, what can we do to reverse it if that's possible, or keep it from happening, you know, even better, or at worst, just slow it down so that I don't end up having that heart attack and disappearing from the planet.
Sure.
So do you think we can cover those things in our time together?
Sure. We'll do the first one is, you know, just what is plaque and how does it form?
Yeah.
Then we'll go into, you know, how do you go looking for it? And three, how do you go best treating it? So first off, you know, what is plaque? Well, let's start with how does plaque begin? You have 60,000 miles of blood vessels. Lining the blood vessels is a layer called the endothelium. It is one cell thick. It's a protective coating. If that protective coating is healthy, you don't tend to develop plaque. Hmm. They give it like Teflon or nonstick surface. Huh. A couple of years ago, it really got, you know, more understood that the endothelium has another layer on top of it called the endothelial glycocalyx. Huh. It's a protective gel coat. So if you think of taking a fish out of water and it's slimy,
yeah,
that's essentially what the lining of your arteries has in it.
Huh.
If that coating is healthy, the cholesterol particles, the white blood cells, everything just slides on by. But if that coating gets damaged from high blood sugars, insulin, infections, heavy metals, pollution, multiple of things can damage this protective gel coat, mm-hmm, then the lipoproteins tend to start sticking to the arteries like Velcro. They get retained in the artery wall. They basically start causing swelling in the artery wall as the body starts investigating why are these lipoproteins coming into the arterial wall. And the white blood cells start gobbling it up. And then that starts the process of developing these foam cells, which eventually become plaques. The body is just trying to take care of this plaque by forming a scar over it so you can keep leading your life. But if these plaques continue to build up, it's kind of like a pimple on the wall of the artery. If that pimple ruptures, then your blood clots and you have a heart attack. Many people, that's the first sign that they have plaque in their arteries is one of these plaques rupture. Other people have plaque in their arteries that kind of builds up slowly over time. The plaque may calcify, and they may have a 70, 80, 90% blockage or stenosis in their artery. And when that happens, they often will have symptoms when they exercise. You know, they'll have chest pain, shortness of breath, exercise intolerance. You know, they stop the activity, the symptoms go away. They have a severe blockage in their artery, and they may or may not get a stent or bypass surgery for it. And their symptoms might get better with that, but that doesn't reduce the risk of them having a heart attack or reduce the risk of dying. They're just spot welding small areas of blockage. Hmm. They didn't fix why you got that blockage in the first place. If you don't fix it and get to the root cause, it's like whack-a-mole. They'll be back in there 6 months, 12 months, 18 months later. Hmm. So that's one of the reasons I kind of stepped out of the cath lab, is I thought there has to be a better way to prevent these people from keep showing up in the cath lab. So that's what plaque is. Your second question is like, how do you go looking for it?
Yeah, let me ask you a question first. Because first of all, I want to throw something out here for the audience's sake that I've heard you say before, but you didn't mention it this time. And that was this idea of the check engine light, where the, you know, you've got this problem, obviously, like everyone's driving a car and the light comes on and you've got a problem. And if all you managed to do was, you know, unscrew the bulb and the light goes out, nobody would feel good that they did the right thing on that. But that's what we're doing lots of times in these interventions. The stent is an example, you were saying. Okay, but I just wanted to try to summarize that you were saying that the main thing was the endothelial lining in the glycocalyx that is sort of this shield that makes the artery wall protected from stuff, including these ApoB containing particles, and that the number of particles, I think, does matter, but it only matters a lot if the glycocalyx is damaged. Am I following that right?
That's my understanding, is that, you know, if your glycocalyx is relatively healthy,
yeah,
you're less likely to go down the path where you're going to get these ApoB particles retaining in your endothelium. It is possible, but statistically less likely. Because the other fact that we'd often see, and it's still true to this day, is that half the time when people show up in the hospital with a heart attack,
yeah,
they have, quote, normal cholesterol. Mm. In the hospital, they're not checking lipoproteins. They're not checking ApoB. They're just checking traditional cholesterol panels. So people will get confused. Like, well, how can you have plaque with normal cholesterol? You had a damaged glycocalyx, and it didn't matter how much cholesterol particles you had. They were getting retained in the artery wall.
Yeah, I guess over a long enough period of time, if you don't have the shielding, it's going to happen. So why does the glycocalyx get damaged?
Again, it's kind of like a protective coating. It's always kind of breaking down and rebuilding, but sometimes you're into like more damage than you can repair mode.
Yeah.
It's oxidative stress and inflammation are the two biggest things that damage it. And many people are metabolically unwell. You know, they're insulin resistant, pre-diabetic. I don't think too many people smoke anymore, but there are people who still vape. You know, that significantly thrashes the glycocalyx. Infections, you know, COVID-19 being an example, significantly damage the microcirculation. Mm. You know, heavy metals, microplastics. There's a recent study that came out where patients who were getting carotid endarterectomies, which is a surgery to remove the plaque in the arteries on the side of your neck,
yeah,
they visualized the plaques with a microscope. And half those people approximately had plastics inside those plaques.
Yikes.
Where did that plastic come from? Probably a combination of them drinking it in their food, their water, and possibly some of it is inhaling it. So we're just always getting bombarded by multiple insults. It's just, how well is that glycocalyx holding up to those insults?
I see. So the faster the rate of the insults, the more likely it is that the damage is going to accumulate, because it's going, correct, to be too fast for your body's ability to heal from the damage. So people who smoke, for example, that they smoke a lot, and they, you know, it's not like they smoke one day a week, but would like alcohol have an effect on that sort of a thing?
But more than indirectly, just probably from the oxidative stress of the alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a direct effect.
And I'll tell you that I heard the word glycocalyx from Ivor Cummins from years ago, who I'd sort of dismissed as a bit of a crank. I'm probably wrong about that. But what he had said was that it was damaged by high blood sugar. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. High blood sugar and high insulin are some of the major drivers of glycocalyx damage.
Wow. Okay. All right. So whether you can avoid that with diet or just by maybe having a healthy mitochondria, which are using up this glucose in your blood and not letting it rise, somehow you got to figure out how to get the blood sugar down. And what else? I think I've heard you say that uric acid is something that can cause damage.
Correct. Yeah, there's many things that can damage it. You know, uric acid causes a lot of oxidative stress on the lining of the glycocalyx. Uric acid, you know, when it's high enough, will crystallize and can increase the risk of gout, which is a painful arthritis. But even if you don't have gout, high uric acid is often a sign of metabolic dysfunction. Your body may not be breaking down fructose or alcohol or protein very well, and this level builds up and it can directly damage the glycocalyx.
Okay. Okay. So I guess I'm interested in understanding this business of how do you find out? And so you had alluded to some things like you get out of breath when you're going up the stairs, and let's focus first on the sort of the body symptoms. You know, how might I get a clue that I really should look into this? But then what other things could be done, you know, like a blood test or scans of some sort?
So, you know, most patients, you know, for a cardiologist, they're showing up with some type of symptoms. You know, many people are not going to a cardiologist when they feel well and trying to optimize and be like, hey, I never want to go down this pathway. So having symptoms is a little bit late to the game. Maybe not too late to the game where you're going to end up with a heart failure or a heart attack or something bad happening, but you're going to need a lot more aggressive intervention once you start having symptoms. And those symptoms often are unmasked with exercise because you're putting more demand on the body. You know, as you increase the heart rate, you know, the myocardium needs more oxygen nutrients. So if you have a fixed blockage in one of your arteries, or if you have microvascular disease, at some heart rate, you're not going to be able to provide the oxygen nutrients to the tissues. And that person will start developing some type of symptoms. It may be pain, pressure, tightness in the chest. It may be shortness of breath. It may be just don't feel well. You feel nauseated. Or it was an exercise that used to be really easy, and then at very low levels of activity, you're like, I can't do this anymore. And this was easy 6 months ago. Mm. You stop the activity, the heart rate starts slowing down, and your symptoms generally go away within 5-10 minutes. And for the most part, every time you do that type of activity and get your heart rate up to that same number, you'll have those exact same symptoms. That is what's considered stable angina. You would see a cardiologist, they would often do an EKG. They may do an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, to look at the heart function. And then they would likely do a stress test. And if you're able-bodied, they're going to put you on the treadmill, and they may or may not do imaging with that stress test. And the stress test is trying to recreate the symptoms you have. And they're going to watch your EKG while you're exercising, see if the EKG becomes abnormal. Also, if they add imaging, then they can see if the heart muscle is squeezing well at peak activity. If you have a severe blockage, the heart won't squeeze well at peak activity. You'll have what's known as a wall motion abnormality on an echocardiogram, or if you're doing a nuclear stress test, you'll have a perfusion defect. It looks like somebody took a bite out of the heart and there's not enough blood flow going to that area. If the stress test is abnormal, that may lead to a coronary angiogram where, you know, they're going to put a catheter in your right radial artery or in your femoral artery and feed catheters up into the heart, and they'll, you know, inject contrast down the heart arteries and tell you, yeah, you have severe blockages and we recommend a stent or bypass, or nope, you don't have severe blockages. But the problem really comes in when the people have no, quote, severe blockages. They say, like, you don't need a stent, but you don't go back to fix the root causes of why they may have had symptoms in the first place. They may not need a stent right now, but you don't fix them by doing an angiogram. You just told them that they're not super late to the game. So you want to really do testing well before the person is symptomatic. Now, these plaques can begin in your teens and 20s, but they don't usually become clinically evident until you're 40, 50, 60 years old. You asked a question earlier, like, are plaques inevitable? For the most part, if you live long enough, yes. But most people don't necessarily die from vascular disease. They die with it. You're trying to be that type of person. So how do you go looking at the arteries? Well, there's testing that can kind of tell you, well, how healthy is the endothelium? Nitric oxide is the name of the game for that. Nitric oxide is a short-lived gas that dilates the arteries, but nitric oxide also acts kind of like a repellent. It prevents the cholesterol particles from sticking to the arteries. So testing the endothelium, you can use devices like the EndoPat. It's a 15-minute non-invasive test that tells you how much your arteries can dilate with a vascular stressor. There's pulse wave velocity, which tells you how elastic your arteries are. Looks like a pulse ox. And when your blood gets ejected from your heart, if you're arteries are healthy, they expand and contract very quickly, like an accordion. So the more elastic your arteries, the healthier the arteries. Your blood pressure is a good surrogate for it. Your blood pressure really should be less than 120 over 80. But there's devices that can measure your central blood pressures. Those are the blood pressures that your heart arteries, your brain, your kidneys all sense. That also should be less than 120 over 80.
Let me jump in on the blood pressure thing. I've heard of a thing called pulse pressure, which I guess is the difference between the systolic and the diastolic. And it should be 30 or more or something like that. And that is an indication of how stretchy the arteries are. Is that right? Is that a thing to watch?
You don't want to have a really narrow pulse pressure. So if you have like very high diastolic pressures, then the the blood vessels are not very elastic. And then there's also converse. You don't want to have wide pulse pressure. Then often the person has aortic regurgitation and they'll have like a systolic blood pressure like 150, and then the diastolic pressure will be 40 or 50, and they think, oh, I don't have high blood pressure. You have major valve disease and you might need a valve replacement. So it is something to look at, but it's not the be-all end-all.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I guess we would love to have silver bullets, probably there's few end-all be-alls. And what about HRV? Does your heart rate variability come into play here, or heart rate, resting heart rate?
So resting heart rate, most people's will fall between 60 and 100. And if you're more of a person who's in good cardiorespiratory fitness, your resting heart rate can be less than 60, and that's still normal. And the converse is your heart rate variability. The higher your heart rate, the lower your heart rate variability. And heart rate variability has a large genetic predisposition to it. But in many people, it's kind of a marker of how much stress their body's sensing right at that moment, either mental or physical stress. And so athletes can use it to see if they're overtraining, if they're well rested, what is breaking their HRV? Is it too much alcohol? Is it not enough sleep? Is it too much that their meals are too late? Are they getting sick? They can use that as a check engine light. If your HRV is dropping off your baseline, something changed in your environment. You got to figure out what that is that's affecting your body.
Yeah. But what if it's like low all the time?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, it depends on, what is low? What is the device monitoring it? This is a nuanced question. It's like most of the data on HRV was done in sick patients in the hospital who had heart attacks. They were on telemetry wards, and the patients who had low HRV at 30 days did worse than the people who had high HRV. But it depends on what monitor you're using. In my experience, I've tried many of the rings and the bands and such. Some of them are accurate. Some of them are completely wrong. So if you have, quote, low HRV, the only way I would say that you can confirm that it's low is that you're actually using a heart rate strap that measures it over your chest and using an appropriate app to measure it then. If that says you're low, okay, you're low. But is it low off your baseline? That's really the question.
But if you're doing, so baseline, if you're doing it, I mean, I hear people and they say, oh, I'm always really low. I mean, sometimes I'm lower than that, but I'm 20, I'm 18. And that's just like my regular thing. Would that indicate, could that just be a normal thing, or could that indicate some cardiovascular issue that would add to the stack of things that say you really should get checked out?
It's just one of the data points I look at. I look at it in every patient that comes into my office, but it does take a history. Is the person sleeping well? Are they, managing the stress? I tell people stress is normal, but it's how you manage it is really the key.
Yeah.
If you're an athlete and you're crushing in the gym every single day and you're not allowing the body to rest 7.5, 8 hours, that exercise can become maladaptive. Exercise is a drug. If you do none, it's bad. There's a large window of benefit. And then there's the ultra endurance athletes. That's a skill, but that's tremendously taxing to the vascular system. Mm. Many of those patients develop heart rhythm issues. They develop earlier atherosclerosis because their bodies are so inflamed from that excessive exercise load. So really low HRV in those individuals is just a sign that they need to peel it back.
Okay. But not a heart condition, just they're over-exercising, they're overtrained.
They're overtraining their nervous system.
Okay. And what about erectile dysfunction?
ED equals ED. So endothelial dysfunction equals erectile dysfunction. So if guys are having issues with erections, which, as a 40-year-old person, that's maybe 20-30% of guys. But once you start getting to be 60-70, it's like 70% of guys will experience it at some point. And so ED is an issue with the microcirculation. You can't get enough blood flow into the penis to maintain an erection. So it's often the canary in the coal mine for some guys. So, it's a topic that, I don't always see as the first thing that patients are coming to me. That's their complaint. But I always do ask it. And they're just like, oh, yeah, this has been going on for a while. I'm like, this was your canary in the coal mine that you've had vascular disease for 10 years, and you're just finding it now. So sometimes guys will tell their primary care doctors, or if they're seeing a urologist for other reasons, they'll tell them this. They need to then go see a cardiovascular specialist to make sure that their heart is doing okay.
Okay, and so guys that take, Viagra or Cialis for this exact problem, and that helps them. I mean, I guess I have heard that it doesn't help some people, but for the guys that it helps, they're like, problem solved. Is that true?
So you're right that some guys benefit, some guys don't. It's maybe 50-50. And so how do these medicines work? They're known as phosphodiesterase inhibitors. Nitric oxide, as I mentioned earlier, it's a gas, and it causes the smooth muscle and artery walls to relax. When that happens, blood flow increases. So nitric oxide dilates arteries. The medications like Viagra, Cialis, they do not provide nitric oxide to the body, but they block its breakdown. So it keeps it around longer so it can work for a more extended period of time. But in the Viagra non-responders, it's basically like they didn't put any nitric oxide into the funnel. There's no nitric oxide to keep around. So it doesn't work for them. I tell patients, you know, if they use these medicines, you know, that is not a bad thing per se, but it means that there's a problem with your blood vessels. If you have problems with your blood vessels to your penis, you may have blood vessel problems to your coronary arteries, your carotid arteries, your other vital organs.
Well, it does sound like if you have ED and you're taking Viagra or Cialis and it doesn't work for you, that should be a big red flag. That means you have very low nitric oxide in your body. And you were saying that is one of your defense mechanisms against damage to your artery walls.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Everybody hearing that, go see your doctor. All right. So what else? I'm looking for mostly for physical symptoms. And we've talked a lot about that. Blood tests. Did we go through blood tests that people could get to get a clue? I think we did talk about uric acid, but I've heard you mention some other things, high sensitivity CRP, oxidized LDL, things like that. What do you use?
Sure. So, I mean, there's a whole host of labs that you can check. When I do new patient workups, it's an 8 to 9 page report, a couple hundred different variables. But I usually kind of break it down to three big buckets. Bucket one is the labs that tend to affect nitric oxide and the glycocalyx. Bucket two is the oxidative stress and the inflammation markers. And then bucket three is the lipoproteins. So the nitric oxide and the glycocalyx labs, we talked about one, uric acid, but homocysteine also can cause issues. This is also where you can do a urine test called the urine microalbumin creatinine ratio. If that number is high, that's a marker that the glycocalyx of the kidneys is impaired and the person's leaking protein into the urine. Asymmetric dimethylarginine, ADMA, that can also cause issues with nitric oxide availability. I'll keep it short for that. The second big bucket, the inflammatory markers, yes, high sensitivity CRP is a good one. It just doesn't tell you where that fire is at, so you got to keep looking.
Okay.
But there's some vascular-specific inflammatory markers, particularly LPPLA2 or plaque, PLAC, and the other one is called myeloperoxidase. If either of those two are elevated, your arteries are essentially on fire, and you got to figure out what's putting that fire into the arteries and how you can shut it off. The oxidized LDL, oxidized phospholipid ApoB, so are you rusting quickly from the inside out? And then an old school test, GGT, gamma glutal transferase. If that level is high, then you have very low levels of glutathione, and your body doesn't have a lot of oxidative defenses.
So you have high oxidative stress.
If you're stressed, you rust. Fun fact is the majority of the life insurance companies, that GGT will be included on the panel that they check on people. If your GGT is high, they're probably going to rate you much higher or not offer you life insurance because it's associated with higher mortality if you have high GGT. So if the insurance companies know something, then that's why they test it. And then the third thing is the lipoproteins. And we go really deep if you want, but the easiest way to think about it is like, what number of LDL particles do you have floating around in your blood? You can also use apolipoprotein B. And then once in your life, people should have lipoprotein little a checked and see if that is elevated. It's like LDL on steroids. It's much more likely to cause atherogenesis, plaque in the arteries, or thrombogenesis, clotting.
But it doesn't change much over your life. So it's maybe genetic. It's not diet.
It's not diet. It's genetically predetermined. With high inflammation, it will increase. But at this time, there are not great nutraceuticals or pharmaceutical treatments that significantly lower LPA. The PCSK9 inhibitors may lower it 25 to 30%. Okay. Does that clinically benefit? Nobody knows for sure. But there are drugs, in the pipeline, some antisense oligonucleotides and small interfering RNA molecules that will basically shut off the liver's ability to make LPLA, and it's going to drop LPA by, 99%. Those will likely hit the market in the next year or two.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, Hopefully. I actually have had my LP little a tested and I'm low. So, you know, thank you, Mom and Dad.
Yep.
I remember that in a talk that you gave, that you had kind of outlined this question of, even though the particle count, the ApoB particle count is maybe secondary to the damage to the glycocalyx and the lining of the artery, it still matters. And so, and it, especially if it's really high, you should do something about it. And you walked through a number of different ways that that ends up occurring, different problems in the body that have different things that could be done. So we're going to get to the things that could be done here in just a second. But could you walk us through, for the audience's sake, this business of there's, you know, there's, you can make too much or not remove enough or reabsorb too much or, you know, what that whole system of problems that accumulate.
Sure. And so, you know, when I do this with patients, you know, we're always going through the lens of, you know, is this primary or secondary prevention? Secondary prevention means you've already had an event, heart attack, stroke, stents, bypass.
Or a high CAC score.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, what is the true cutoff for high CAC? Probably to consider like a coronary equivalent, a CAC of 300 is probably the same as having, you've had a prior heart attack. Mm. So those people should be treated with standard of care medications because the data is very clear. You can reduce their second events with it. The primary prevention, it does have benefit, but it's not as robust. So that's really kind of where a lot of the questions come in on lipid-lowering therapy. So I get a lot of patients come in who patients are told that I have, quote, high cholesterol and my doctor wants me to take a statin. I say, well, let's see a couple things. You know, show me your arteries. Are your arteries full of plaque? Do you have endothelial dysfunction? If so, yes, it's probably reasonable to do something at this point to throw the kitchen sink at the person to kind of lower all the risk factors all at once. The blood testing can kind of guide you where they're likely having issues. There's a test called the cholesterol balance test. It looks at, are you a hyperproducer of sterols? Or are you a hyperabsorber of sterols? So sterols, cholesterol, it's a waxy compound. It cannot float in your liquid blood. So the body's going to make these lipoproteins to wrap them up. But the liver's producing landosterol and desmosterol, and those get broken down into cholesterol. And then your body makes a lipoprotein and wraps it up and then ships it out through the blood vessels, and then the muscles and other organs bind to it, pull out what it needs, the triglycerides or vitamins out of the lipoprotein, ships it back to the liver. The liver then basically has to catch it with an LDL receptor. So it's like a cargo docking station. It grabs that ApoB particle, brings it back into the liver, breaks it down, puts it ultimately into the intestines, and that's how the cholesterol leaves the body. Mm. There's a receptor in the gut called the Niemann C1-like receptor that in some individuals essentially doesn't do its job at keeping the cholesterol from refluxing or coming back to the liver. Hmm. So it's kind of like having a bouncer who took the night off and everybody just comes on through the door. So there's beta-sitosterol and composterol. Those are levels that you can check. Those are plant sterols. If your body's bringing back a lot of those compounds, then it's also pumping back a lot of cholesterol. So you can use this test to kind of infer, like, if the person's a hyperproducer of sterols, they're likely to respond better to statins or bempedoic acid, which is Nexletol. The people who are hyperabsorbers of sterols, they tend to respond better to ezetimibe. You know, that blocks cholesterol reabsorption. Now, there's some people that are neither. They're neither a hyperproducer or they're not a hyperabsorber of sterols, but their lipids are still very elevated. Okay, what's going on in those people? The issue with them is that it's their LDL receptor. The LDL receptor sits on the outside of the liver as that docking station. Maybe they just don't have very many docking stations. The docking stations, you know, basically misformed. And so the cholesterol particles can't bind to it. So that's what happens with patients with familial hyperlipidemia. They have genetic abnormalities where that LDL receptor doesn't work very well. And they'll have, you know, LDL cholesterols of 200, 300, 400 milligrams a deciliter. You know, that's very high. ApoE4 carriers sometimes have issues with their LDL receptors and they'll have very high levels. They're not necessarily overproducing. It's the receptors don't work very well. Mm-hmm. So the receptors don't work. Then that's where the PCSK9 inhibitors, Repatha, Praluent, Ilisclerin, you block the enzyme that breaks your LDL receptor, the PCSK9, and then the receptors you do have to stay out all day long, plucking those ApoB particles as they go by.
Hmm. Okay. And so without some investigation into what particular problem a person with high cholesterol has, just throwing a statin at them, I mean, you're kind of guessing that they're just making too much. But if they're a person who's absorbing too much, or their receptors are not grabbing enough away, then you're going to have a small effect, I guess. And maybe that's why they keep upping the dose to try to get more. And of course, you up the side effects as well.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, statins have been on the market, you know, since the 1980s. They have millions and millions of people who have used them. And so there's a clear, you know, benefit for certain people. But it is one of those cases where you have to individualize it to the person, because certain doses work for people. Sometimes high doses are needed, but not everybody can tolerate high doses of statins. You know, often, you know, if patients come to me and they're already on statins and they're having side effects, then I will check ApoE. If they're an ApoE4 carrier, they may not tolerate the highest dose statins. So back off and, you know, maybe add ezetimibe to the regimen as well, or add bempedoic acid and take off the statin. You know, if the person has a gene called SLCO1B1, 3 to 4 times increased risk of having muscle symptoms with statins. So maybe those are the people you shouldn't challenge with high dose statins. That's a relatively simple blood test. There's also a company that has some oral swabs that can tell you, do you have the statin myopathy gene? If you do, those people, don't challenge them. Use something else.
Wow.
But the case is, the body is really smart, is that if you shut off the cholesterol production, the body will just try to start reabsorbing from the gut. So often I use the analogy, and it's pretty good, is think of a bathtub that's filling up full of water. You know, the water is the cholesterol. To prevent the water from overflowing the bathtub and getting over to the floor, 3 things you can do. You can go in there and shut off the faucet so the water stops going in. That's basically like using a statin or bempedoic acid. Dial back how much is being produced. The drain in the bathtub is like the LDL receptor. If it's really, really narrow and you don't have very many of them, it takes forever the water to get out of the bathtub. It may overflow. So use a PCSK9 inhibitor to open it up. Once the water's into the kind of sewer, you want to make sure it actually goes out to the main line. Some people have a blockage in the sewer. This is where ezetimibe comes in, is that it makes sure that the blockage is relieved and it actually goes out to the sewer. So sometimes the best case of action is to use low doses of 2 things, and they're more synergistic together than just trying to hammer away at one of the pathways.
Well, that's interesting. And I wonder if there isn't a role maybe for nutritional supplements in some of these things to augment some of this. I've heard you talk about garlic and berberine and things like that, that are, of course, they're not as powerful as a pharmaceutical, but have some effect, some benefit for some people.
Correct. And that's, you know, the caveat, you know, this is obviously not medical advice. So you have to talk to the person who's helping you manage your lipids. But berberine is something that is used for patients who often have blood sugar regulation issues. So it acts a little bit like metformin. But berberine also has an effect on the LDL receptor. It's a weaker oral PCSK9 inhibitor. It's nowhere near as strong as the injectable Repatha and Praluent, but some people get a benefit of it, especially if they're on like low-dose statin plus berberine. It's more synergistic at helping those LDL receptors stay out longer and pluck those ApoB particles out of the circulation.
Nice. And bergamot, what is that?
So it's an Earl Grey tea. It's a citrus from Italy. And bergamot is a HMG coreductase inhibitor. So that's the enzyme that statins work on. It is also not as potent as a statin. So in some people, they may try bergamot, and if they get to their ApoB goals with that and lifestyle interventions, great, stay there. But if it doesn't work for you after 3 to 4 months and lifestyle interventions and you're higher risk, you really should be considering the pharmaceutical agents at that point.
Yeah. Okay. But ultimately, the first line of attack or defense, I guess, depending on how you like to say it, is getting your glycocalyx healthy again. And whether they're unhealthy or they're just getting unhealthy, that seems like that should be job one, to make sure that you're dealing with that. Why don't we move into this? What can people do? I think we already moved into that, but let's talk about really going after trying to have healthy glycocalyx. What are the things people can do to do that?
So before I jump down there, 2 things, you know, is, you talked about it earlier, is the calcium score test. If you've not had a heart attack, stents, bypass, and you're over the age of 35, you should consider a CT coronary calcium scan.
Okay.
Because if your calcium score is over zero, you're higher risk of having a heart attack, irrespective of you having symptoms, and you're going to be more aggressive with your risk factors.
All right.
Now, to answer your question about the glycocalyx, a lot of times it's about withdrawing the offending agents that are damaging it. So you have high oxidized lipids, high inflammation, high homocysteine, high uric acid, fix those root causes. If you haven't been able to fix those completely, then there are things that can support nitric oxide. There are different lozenges or capsules that can give your body nitric oxide if you can't produce it on your own. And then there are glycocalyx promoters. They basically have building blocks that help regrow the gel coat in the arteries. And so for anybody who has significant vascular disease, often you're using a combination of a nitric oxide promoter as well as a glycocalyx regeneration agent.
So are we talking about like eating beets and making sure that I'm not using mouthwash or something like that?
So that's for the nitric oxide pathways. So you have, two pathways to make nitric oxide. There's a pathway when the blood flows over the glycocalyx. This is, active when you're exercising. The blood stimulates the glycocalyx to send a signal down to the endothelium, and then the endothelium releases nitric oxide and the arteries dilate. When you're outside in sunlight and you're getting UVA sunlight on your skin, the arteries dilate because they're releasing nitric oxide. And then you mentioned beets. So beets and dark green leafy vegetables have dietary nitrates in them. When you eat those nitrates, if you have healthy bacteria in your saliva, those nitrate-reducing bacteria will break it down into nitrites. Those nitrites then get swallowed, and then as long as you have stomach acid, eventually there will be a reaction that makes nitric oxide. So you have two pathways to make nitric oxide. If one pathway breaks, the other pathway can be the backup. If both pathways are broken, you're likely to have high blood pressure, stiff arteries, and go down the pathway where you're developing plaque in your arteries. Now, can you eat enough nitrates in your diet to always have enough nitric oxide? Some people can, but most people don't eat as many that they need. And then there's also kind of a challenge, and this is something I learned from Dr. Nathan Bryan, was that organic foods have 1/10 amount of nitrates in them than conventionally grown foods.
Because of the fertilizer.
Because it's because of the fertilizer. Yeah. So organic is great for not getting pesticides and glyphosate, but you're not getting as much nitrates in it. So you're going to have to eat a ton more greens and beets that are organic. And so it gets a little bit more challenging with just the dietary approach for some people.
Yeah. Although there are supplements. I personally take a supplement. I did a podcast on nitric oxide not that long ago. And ever since I have been doing the test strips and I quit brushing my tongue and I changed my tooth. I had to go through like 12 steps to try to figure out how do I get that stinking test strip to be pink instead of right. White? And I've been doing it ever since. And so my solution is I eat celery every day. And I also take a supplement in the morning because apparently the dietary approach doesn't last. It doesn't have a very long lasting effect. So you've got to kind of keep redosing yourself. At least that was my experience using the test strips as the indicator. Well, and how can you get your ENOS working again? I understood that it declined as you got older, but maybe that's because you get more inflammation or whatever. I don't know what is causing it. And how would you reverse it back?
So ENOS, or endothelial nitric oxide synthase, that's the enzyme that on the lining of your arteries converts arginine, which is an amino acid, to citrulline. And with that process, nitric oxide gets kicked off. There's many cofactors or things that the ENOS enzyme needs to kind of crank and go around quickly. But after the age of 40 or so, that enzyme starts to slow down. So it becomes less and less efficient at converting the arginine to citrulline. So you're never really low in the amino acid arginine. So you can take all the arginine powders you want in the world. That's not the problem. Mm-hmm. It's the ENOS enzyme's the issue. So there are micronutrient testing. You can see, like, are you low in certain micronutrients that ENOS needs? But there are commercially available supplements that can help support the ENOS enzymes. And so that's what a lot of those oral dissolving lozenges do.
Ah, okay. Okay, good. So it's good. Well, there's a couple of different ways we can go. And then I'm assuming the thing that we haven't talked about yet, which is the circadian rhythm biology, is somewhat somehow related into this like lowering of inflammation and letting the glycocalyx heal and going down that path. Am I guessing right?
So, I mean, your circadian biology is your 24-hour cycles, and there's two main Zeitgebers or time givers that help set it. It's the light that enters your eyes and interacts with something called your melanopsin receptors, which are basically blue light detectors,
yeah.
And then the timing of your meals. For most people, your optimal feeding window, no matter what kind of diet you choose, is from sunup to sundown, because it's a message to your body that it's still daytime. Mm-hmm. The light in your eyes, you know, before they invented light bulbs, you know, it was sunlight, you know, or you had fire, and the same as the converse. The sun would set, no more blue light would hit your eyes, and your body would know, oh, it must be nighttime, and you go to sleep a few hours after that. But with the ubiquitous of our devices and artificial lights, our brains get confused and still think it's noontime and keep pumping out cortisol. So many people want to focus on nutrition and exercise, and they're important levers for optimal health, but you do have to manage your stress and you have to sleep well. It's the most important pillar of all of them. If you don't sleep well, it almost does not matter what you eat or exercise, because your mitochondria, the organelles in your cells that make energy for you, they're repairing while you sleep. So if you chronically short sleep yourself, and in part your circadian rhythms are out of balance and causing you not to sleep well, you're not going to age well. Your cardiovascular system is not going to age well. So that's why I'm so big about talking about circadian biology with my patients. Anybody's ever seen my social media, I'm always wearing the blue blocking glasses of them inside in front of technology.
Right.
One, it's part of my brand, but two, it's I just lead by example. This is what I do for myself. Works for me. My sleep's awesome. I'll put my sleep scores up against anybody's. And then, you know, that helps with the heart repairing itself. You know, the heart by weight is 1/3 mitochondria. You know, your heart has 5,000 mitochondria per cell. If your mitochondria are healthy, your heart is healthy. If your mitochondria are not healthy, bad things happen to your heart or in your brain. You know, so that's why they're all really are tied together. Circadian biology, your mitochondria, heart health.
Okay, this is good. And of course, you've stepped right on my sore spot of all of my efforts to become a healthier person so I can be a strong athlete for a long time. Sleep is my worst thing, and it is better. I've been working on it all this year, and it is better. It had sort of regressed a little bit recently, and I realized I was drinking a ton of coffee, and I quit drinking coffee, and boom, I'm back to sleeping pretty good. But still, I want to sleep more. You know, I'm sleeping like 6.5 to 7 hours. I want 8. So give us your wisdom on, you know, what's the full Monty? If you really, really wanted to be healthy this way, what would you do? What do you do?
So I would design a day that you could live and repeat like Groundhog's Day as many days as you could. You know, vascular disease is common, but if you take the appropriate interventions, you don't go down the pathway of ending up in the hospital with a heart attack. You know, so do the testing to figure out where you're at on that pathway already. If you live long enough, you will probably develop plaque, but it can be managed. But back to the day, you know, you should ideally have the exact same wake up and bedtime 7 days a week, no matter what. Your body craves that consistency. Most people should be awake right before or right shortly after the sunrise, wherever their sunrise is in their environment. That's the primary Zeitgeber or time giver to the body. You should be outside after sunrise. 15 minutes or so would be great. More might be better. But that bright morning light sets your supracosmic nucleus, tells the rest of the body what time of day it is, and all your other hormones start getting regulated. Then the trick is blocking artificial light at night. You know, before the late 1800s, you had fire or it was dark. Try to recreate what all our ancestors had up until about 100 years ago. So you can wear the, you know, the biohacker blue blockers. You can just go back to having, you know, more dim environments. You know, my office here, it's all natural lighting. You know, at home, I have skylights. So when it gets dark outside, it's pretty dark in the place. Might have some red lights so people aren't tripping over things. Hmm. But if it's dark, you get tired, you go to bed at a reasonable time. So, you know, my average bedtime now is 9-ish or so, up by 5 every single day. Hmm. You know, before I did this type of regimen, you know, bed at midnight, up by 8, like, eventually your body settles into those rhythms. Mm-hmm. So it's not complicated to do it. It may be complicated to understand all the science and physics behind it. You know, I'm most curious people want to know exactly how things work, but that is kind of the thing. It's like, I will just lead by example and show you. And then we're like, well, how do you do it? I'll show them and then I'll explain it to them.
All right. So let me hit you with a couple of questions. Aspirin, baby aspirin.
So if you've had an event, yes. For primary prevention, it depends. Most studies are going to say like primary prevention, it depends on your bleeding risk. But I don't truly believe that everybody who says they're primary prevention truly are. They just haven't done a sensitive enough test to tell you that they actually have plaque in their arteries. So if they've had a CT angiogram, ideally using AI algorithms to look at the plaque, then you can say they're truly low risk and aspirin maybe is more bleeding risk. But many people would benefit from being on low-dose aspirin.
Okay. And how about the use of like a red light, near-infrared light as kind of a stand-in for the early morning or shady sunshine for people who, they just got scheduling issues and they're struggling to get into the sun?
So that's what I sometimes joke is that a lot of these things are supplements. You know, they're supposed to augment your natural sun exposure. So these red light panels, which I know a lot about them and have many of them in my office and use them at home, they're great at helping your mitochondria produce energy, but they're not a stand-in for sunlight. So they do not set your circadian rhythms. You need the full spectrum of light from sunlight to do that. Where they can help is for musculoskeletal injuries, decreasing pain, inflammation, improving blood flow to the tissues. It does stimulate nitric oxide release from the mitochondria. So there's many benefits, but it's not a stand-in for the sun.
And tell me about vitamin D. I mean, we get vitamin D from the sun. And I think what you're saying is that we get other things from the sun too. And so vitamin D is not sunshine in a pill. What do you think about vitamin D?
So vitamin D is a hormone. It's, like you said, it is not a pill. Your body produces vitamin D when sunlight strikes your skin. It's when it's the UVB wavelengths of light striking your skin. And then the cholesterol in your skin is sulfated into a form of vitamin D, and then it gets activated in the liver and the kidneys. But there's approximately 300 other compounds that your body produces when sunlight strikes your skin. And if you're just taking oral vitamin D, you don't get those 300 other compounds. So I teach all my patients how to do it appropriately. If you're not used to the sun, you do have to build up a kind of a solar callus, but there are apps. One app I particularly recommend is called D-Minder Pro. The D-Minder Pro app just tells you where in your environment, when you log on to the app, if the sun is high enough in the sky that you can make vitamin D that time of year. Where I'm at in St. Louis, there's at least 2 months of the year that the sun never gets high enough, so no UVB gets through the atmosphere, so you don't make vitamin D that part of the year. But this app can kind of help guide people on how to safely expose themselves to sunlight without burning, and then they can optimize their vitamin D's that way.
Okay. Blue blockers. We were just talking about them. I see that you're wearing what look like shooting glasses. So these are yellow, which for a marksman would be enhancing the vision, but you're using it to block certain wavelengths of light. But then I've also seen red glasses. So which ones are used for what?
So the ones that I'm wearing, these are kind of the daytime lenses. They block up to about 465 nanometers of blue light. You don't want to block all blue light because you want your brain to still know that it's daytime. We're talking during daylight. But I'm looking at a computer screen that's set at 5,500 Kelvin, which is solar noon. So that would be a disconnect between what's going on at my biological time and what the light in my eye would be seeing thing at its noontime. So these glasses filter that down. The red lenses that you speak of, they block 100% of blue wavelengths of light, also green. And so essentially your brain gets a signal. It is dead of night, it's midnight. And your brain really shuts down, starts winding down. But those glasses really are only meant post sunset. I'm very sensitive to those type of lenses. I'll be unconscious within half an hour to 60 minutes if I put those glasses on. So I only wear them if I'm traveling, especially if you're flying eastbound and just trying to get your body equilibrated to the environment that you're going to. Or if I just absolutely have to be in bed at a certain time, I'll put them on an hour before I want to go to bed and pretty sure I'll be going to bed at that time.
Wow. Okay. I got some work to do, but I'm going to get me some of these red glasses and hopefully I can get myself to where they actually put me to sleep in 30 minutes. Okay. The last question I've got, for about, 8, 10 years, I have been using a light box first thing in the morning. I think it's, you know, they were a popular thing for seasonal disaffective disorder or something like that. You know, and the idea was, oh, you signal to your body, it's daytime, it's time to get up. And of course, I'm up, it's not sunlight yet. And so I just get this bright light shining in my eyes. But I've heard you say that you don't want the full noon spectrum. In fact, that's not even a full sunlight spectrum. It's a bright light rather than kind of a redder sunrise kind of a light. So am I making a mistake?
These seasonal affective disorder boxes or happy boxes, they can definitely help people who have, you know, the winter blues or seasonal affective disorder. So I don't want to discount them for that. But are they going to ever replace what the sun can do? No. And the time of day does matter. So if you're up before sunrise, you do not want to be exposed to bright light before that time. If you just absolutely can't get to the sun, for whatever reason, which you should find a different way to get away from that and actually get to it, is use the bright light around the time sunset would be in your local environment. But those panels lack the red spectrum and infrared spectrum. So they can photo-age the skin. Your body's getting still an alien light source on it. So I would consider biohacking with having a photobiomodulation panel going off at the same time if you're going to be blasting yourself with one of these seasonal affective disorder lights.
Okay. Oh, and then the last thing I heard you say, and it stunned me, and so I got to get it on the tape here, and that's that for near infrared or infrared while you're driving your car, I mean, the glass is blocking a lot of it, but if you can just crack your windows, then it gets in. Tell us about that.
Correct. And that's the case where, you know, if you're behind glass, the glass will filter out about 40% of the red in the infrared spectrum because it's trying to keep heat on the outside of the building. Right. I often get that question like, oh, it's cold outside. Can I watch the sunrise through my windows at home? Not really, unless you have, you know, quartz glass, which almost nobody has.
Anymore.
So, but if you wanted to watch it from inside, you crack your window. The light spills through. It's like the equivalent of like, think of a fish tank. If you crack the fish tank, all the water falls out. All those wavelengths come right through a very small gap. They bounce around your windows, your mirrors, and they get to the back of the eyes. So you still get the benefit if you do it that way.
All right. Well, that's a great tip. And I've been doing it ever since I heard you say it. Every time I get in the car, I crack the windows down a little bit. So thanks for that. All right, Dr. Twyman, this was really very educational. Thank you, sir. Tell our audience how they can find you online, reach out to you for help if they need it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to chat with you, and hopefully your audience, it sparks some questions for them. And if they want to hit me up, you know, I'm pretty active on social media, on Instagram. Mondays, 6 p.m. Central Time, I do an Ask Me Anything. So the patients can, or potential patients, or just people who are interested in, you know, asking me questions, they can submit their questions ahead of time, or then once it goes live at 6 p.m., if they drop a question in the comments, I usually will try to answer it for the people. It's always being recorded. I always get that question. You don't have to make it live. You can always watch a replay if you're not available for that time. So that's, you know, where I'm active most on social media. And then my website, it's drtwyman.com. There's links to prior podcasts I've done. There's links to different gear that I potentially use myself. So if you're looking for more information about this kind of quantum biology, preventive cardiology practice, go to drtwyman.com.
All right. We'll get all that in the show notes. People can find that there. Thank you again, gentlemen. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Twyman. You can find more information about Dr. Twyman in the show notes. And check out the link for the Wise Athlete's full script site, where you can see where I buy my own supplements that I use to improve my health and ward off the leading cause of death.